It's me, Alison Spittle, and you're very welcome to the Alison Spittle Show. I'm sorry I was away, but I'll be honest with you, life got on top of me and I got too busy, and I'm afraid I let the podcast fall behind. And I know you've been with me for a couple of years, and thank you very much for bearing with me. I got a load of interviews done, and they're coming out over the next little while. And I'm going to keep on top of it because I missed it and I missed ye. So thank you so much. This week's guest is a doozy. We got Jenna Friedman. Jenna Friedman is an amazing comedian from America. And she is on in the Edinburgh Fringe. And I caught up with her at the Vodafone Comedy Festival and we did a podcast together. I really enjoyed the interview. Go have a listen now, and then I'm going to talk about Jenna's show and my show after. I got loads for you to catch up on, show wise for me. All right, chat to you in a minute. Bye. This is the
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Jesus Christ.
I like how that's the command that I wield.
Yeah. I just repeat the stuff.
I just gaslit you. I'm like, this is my podcast.
I feel very out of control now. I feel very out of control. I need to bring it back. Have you ever been to a Denny's?
I have been to a Denny's.
This is the question I ask every American person on my podcast.
Wait, Oh, you've never been to a Denny's?
Never. I've never been to America. I spent the whole time just chatting to my last guest just going, what's this place like?
Denny's, I kind of get it confused with IHOP.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's okay if you're like drunk or after 2 a.m., you know?
Okay.
I'm not a pancake person.
You're not a pancake person.
I don't like pancakes and waffles, but I do like a really good muffin or like a cinnamon bun. I'm more of like a pastry or like a croissant, as you guys call it, croissant.
But you're in Europe now.
I'm in Europe now.
What I was gonna say, I really enjoyed your Soft Focus TV show that you
Thank
have.
You.
Yeah, so good. How did you feel interviewing that McAfee man? He's so scary.
What was creepier was that he was very charismatic. And
really?
All the stuff I knew about him. And then I got there and I think at first he thought I was just some hired reporter. So he was pretty disrespectful or just dismissive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of some of the questions where I was like teasing him about that just came from playing off of his dismissiveness, like he was only asking men like questions and didn't realize I was like totally running the show.
Right.
But then he was charismatic and he like, you know, he does like hire women to shit in his mouth, but Yeah, it was in the Showtime documentary. But they like, I mean, I think if you're like a warlord, like, you know, it could be worse. And it seems like for the most part, he's like respectful. And then he has like an allegation against him for assault, which I did talk to him about. So it's hard to paint somebody as like a feminist warlord. But
yeah. But that's how, like, did he murder someone?
Allegedly, he murdered someone who killed his dogs. And that's the other thing. It's like so...
I didn't know they killed his dogs. Now it's okay.
A lot of... I wasn't going to say it. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, the reason I talked to him, it's so crazy. It's like scary with this stuff because you don't want to like give some psychopath a platform.
Yeah.
But he is running for president. I think he's been like arrested in like the... Like, he's in, like, the Dominican Republic, or he's somewhere right now, but just got arrested again, and, like, I don't know what's going on. There's some new updates on him. But because he's running for president, I felt like he was fair game.
Yeah. I mean, like,
how has other, I mean, mainstream media kind of treated him? Have you been following his?
They haven't. I mean, there are actually one or two movies being made in Hollywood about him.
Right.
Yeah, I think with either Seth Rogen and or Johnny Depp. I'm not really sure.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Johnny Depp, right?
I want to see someone shit in his mouth.
Yeah, I want to see someone shit in his mouth.
How are they going to address that? That's the. I'd love to be a script person on that.
Like, punch up?
Yeah, yeah. Punch them.
More shit in the mouth. Yeah.
So, yeah, what? And you were at his mansion, weren't you? Was that his
compound in an undisclosed location. There was a hammock there. That's how he gets women to shit. Girls, women, who knows at this point, but to shit in his mouth, he has him sit in a hammock, and there was a hammock on the property, and we almost filmed it, and then we just didn't end up filming it because there was this like thing where we did kind of allude to the shit, but it was like, well, you want to be like highbrow about it, or like at least fake highbrow about it. So you didn't want to like, I didn't want to get into the shit too much.
No, because I think if I interviewed him, I'd just be like, tell me about the mechanics. Like,
I wanted to ask him, but I kind of did. And he was like, my body, my choice. And that's such like a nice feminist sentiment that I left it at that.
Yeah. True. How was it to kind of, who approached who about interviewing him? Like,
so I have a nice team of producers and we reached out.
And they were receptive.
Yeah, we found a way to get to him, you know. Without going into how the sausage is made. Yeah, we got to him.
That's interesting. That's cool. And the other segment in the show was like we had like a virtual reality. You had these gamers, they would put on virtual reality kind of glasses and then kind of have an experience of their own. Like, how did you find those? I'm sure like the team found those people, but
so
like,
yeah, that was tricky because I wanted to do a segment about sexual harassment in gaming because no one really takes it seriously because it's gaming. But there are two scenarios. Like one, you know, like women are disproportionately, I mean, everyone's kind of harassed in like multiplayer online games because there's no accountability. You don't see anyone's face. So it's like really easy for people to fuck with people. Can I say fuck?
Yeah, of course.
And so, but then like women's harassment typically skews like more sexual, so then it discourages a lot of girls from going into gaming as a profession, which is like a multi-billion-dollar industry. And then also something I didn't touch upon in the piece because it's just not funny, a lot of virtual harassment can sometimes lead to like actual harassment and like stalking. And the woman we interviewed, she had a scenario where that happened, and so it's not just like hypothetical, it's real, and that's really scary. So I wanted to try to like give guy gamers a little more empathy and do it like meet them where they're at, which is like in games. That was like where the idea to like gamify sexual harassment came from.
So
it's on YouTube. If you Google Jenna Friedman and sexual harassment,
good, that's cool. So people can see it.
People can see it all around the world. But yeah, I mean, the guys were really good sports. I really wanted to be careful to like make sure that the guys that we were doing, we definitely like found a variety of guy. Like, I didn't want them all to be kind of men's rights activists or like angry dudes.
Because it's not all like the most extreme of, you know, it's these reasonable men as well that can do this.
Yeah, and you also don't want to like misrepresent men. Like, there was like a really nice guy that I felt really bad that we did the game to, but you know, he consented and we had to kind of not really tell them exactly what they were experiencing, but it was all in the thing that they signed beforehand, and I made sure they knew like the doors were unlocked and that they were actually safe.
Right.
But yeah, it was like a VR game of them sitting in a room with a guy jerking off. But then also like with each person, we didn't know what we were going to get. So just the live experience was like really tense and insane.
And what was it like after? Like, did you chat to the men after the filming had stopped or?
Not really. No.
Yeah.
One of them has seen the segment and like emails me all the time to be like an intern.
Oh, right.
For the
okay.
next one. So that was cool.
Yeah.
But if they haven't seen the segment, they don't know it's even on air.
Whoa.
Yeah, I don't, I put everything I need to say in writing, but I don't, like, for the most part,
yeah,
explain it to them in the room.
That's cool. Okay.
I mean, I don't know if that's dodgy, but I just, like...
No, because I'm just curious about, like, how much empathy they've developed after, or what's there.
Well, the cool thing that they all did say was that even the ones that were the most extreme angry at women were like, you know, this doesn't make me believe women, but it does give me more empathy, if that makes sense. Like the yeah. like some of them were like, you know, I get what you're doing, and but the even the ones that were kind of more tone deaf were like, I now having experienced something similar, like I this didn't end up in the episode, we cut yeah. it, but in the pre-interview, one of the guys was like, a lot of women lie to like get money from like sexual harassment allegations, and so when it was his time and he went through the thing, and then afterwards I was like, which demo did you get? And he's like, I don't know, some guy just jerked off. And I was like, it was crazy, but I was like, wait, what happened? I'm like, that's not what you were supposed to see.
Wow.
And then I was like, we had to fire an employee recently because of allegations. Maybe he got a hold of the footage, and like I completely made up this whole thing. And then right. I was like, let me look at the footage. And then this was all improvised in real time, and it was just based off of his pre-interview. And then I came back in, and I might sound like a psychopath, so I apologize. But I came back in and I was like, oh, the footage was deleted in the transfer. So I don't have proof of what you're saying, but I'm sure you're not trying to extort us, and I'm just going to believe you.
Wow.
But it was so nuanced and so, like, in the 30-minute period of time that he was with us,
mm-hmm.
like, you're on our side because you're listening to his pre-interview and how vitriolic and, like, mean he sounds. And then we do this thing, and obviously to anyone looking, you're like, obviously we're making this up because of what he said.
Yeah.
But in the moment and the way that it cut and the amount of time that we have to air something, it's like, if you can only air like a minute and a half with this person, like, it just seemed mean.
Yeah.
So we didn't air it.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But there's so much, like, this is the hardest type of comedy to do because it's like unscripted. So you don't know what you're going to get. You're talking about scary subjects. Like, you don't want to be on the wrong side of history. You don't want to be part of the problem. Like, I love men, and I don't want to make them feel sad or bad.
No.
But I do want to, like, have issues like this. I want to be talking about them because they're happening. And so, like, I did another segment on campus rape, and people watching it were like, I can't tell if she's parroting an earnest journalist or she's actually an earnest journalist. But I was like, it doesn't matter. We just put something out there that makes people watch it think about consent, and that's the whole goal.
Yeah. That's what other segments did you do? Other segments that didn't make it into the finished product, or
yes, we did.
Ooh, are you allowed to talk about them? Or?
Yeah, no, I'm doing another episode. It hasn't been announced
Yay!
Yet. Yeah,
cool.
I know it hasn't been announced yet, but on Allison's podcast, announcing it here first. Yeah, I'm. We had a segment on the bathroom bills in America that Republicans are trying to have, basically saying that you have to use a bathroom of the gender that, you know, you were born,
yeah,
or the sex that you were born. And so we did a segment, and Patty Harrison, who's like a brilliant comedian, she co-wrote it with me. And it was wild. But the scary thing is, the guy that we got to do the segment was so much more insane than I had predicted.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give away the joke of the segment, but
yeah.
We wrote something thinking it would go one way, and he was so much more, like, he was, I don't want to say like stupider, but he just like went further than we went even
yeah.
in writing it.
Yeah.
So then the piece just kind of got sad, because at first it was like funny, but he was like so, like, he was like, just, I don't even want to like say some of the things that he thought, because you don't even want to put those into the
yeah.
world. And also it was like, even though like we all know he's wrong, we're making fun of him, like, I don't want to make him look sympathetic. I don't want to air some of the things that he said that are just like so insensitive and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So then I feel like if we do bring that piece back, we might have to rework it. Maybe I shouldn't be the correspondent as a cis woman. It might not make sense. So we have to kind of figure things out. But it was like a funny segment and insane.
Right.
And yeah, no, I mean, it was like, it was really insane to make. And off record, I will tell you all about it.
Nice. I was going to ask as well about what's it like for you? I feel like when you're with McAfee or when you're doing the is it McAfee? Is that how you pronounce it? Or McAfee?
McAfee.
I feel like that must be very draining for you to be funny and also kind of deal with these people and their emotions and keeping to what you want to get for the program. Like,
maybe I do get like a headache after, but it is my favorite thing to do. I mean, I love showing someone in a light, not even from like a feminist perspective, but just like showing a side of somebody that the media missed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I did an interview with Ken Kratz, the guy from Making a Murderer 2.
Oh, wow.
He was like the creepy prosecutor that wouldn't talk on camera. And we got him to sit down with me, and it was so funny because I just kind of like showed how creepy he was without really, like, it was pretty subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I think, and then like the interview I did, I don't know if you ever saw the one I did with the cannibal cop, but he was like this New York City police officer who was busted for plotting to eat his wife.
No.
That's on YouTube too.
Brilliant, right.
Yeah, and he like, he was maligned so much by the media, and we like didn't know what the joke was gonna be. But there's this moment, both him and McAfee, it's like when the media is so mean to you, nothing I do could be worse. So there's like a freedom in that.
Yeah.
And when he found out that I was fucking with him or like joking around, he loosened up so much, and then it became like really, really funny.
Wow.
But I like playing with like tension and like awkwardness, but then also just kind of like peeling back the layers. And like, I totally think he might have killed his wife if it had been like a couple more years. But he didn't. And now he's like an author and writes about horror and has like a constructive outlet for his like pathology or whatever, like cannibalistic ideations. But yeah, I mean,
that's a feel good story.
It's a total feel good story. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, I just think it's like the media is so has no nuance. So when you can like try to add nuance and also make it funny, that's my favorite.
Right. Cool. And that seems like the program is kind of perfect for that aspect of you. But what kind of stuff did you do before that TV show with TV?
Well, I was working at The Daily Show. I worked at Letterman. I had this like little web series I made that I'm trying to get. I wrote a feature about it, but it was like making fun of the New York Times wedding videos, and it was a love story about a woman who falls in love with a serial killer. But it was from her perspective, and he was just kind of like a two-dimensional caricature. And it was really just about like this kind of oblivious woman. And then in the feature version, I kind of took the caricature element out, and it's like really just like, it's a very personal story, and it's very, very grounded, but he happens to be a serial killer, which is just a metaphor for like the worst flaw that someone could have.
Yeah.
But he's very feminist, and she has trust issues, and like that's why they end up not together. Spoiler alert. But I don't know, like I've done like a bunch of sketches too and stuff, you know.
What was it like with Letterman?
It was interesting. It was my first like real job, and I was only there for a year, and it was kind of after he was like checked out. Like, it felt like I was writing for like Bernie from Weekend at Bernie's. He just was like this like checked out person who just didn't care anymore.
Right. And was that, did people feel that in the whole team? Or?
Yeah, so many of them had been there forever. I think I was like the first person I hired in 6 years. And some of them had been writing for him since like the 90s. And they were all really, really nice. And it was like a really good first job.
Cool. But
it was hard to like care about it when the host was just kind of like, I only had like, I met him twice.
Right.
Yeah.
What's your routine like on a day-to-day working for the Letterman show?
At that show, it was like, we were like in a room for 14 hours just like writing jokes and getting assignments like under the door. It was like, it's like one of those like last of the old school jobs.
That sounds great and terrible.
It was, yeah, no, it was, it's tough because they're like the best opportunity. They're like such a great first job, but they are, it's a tough job, especially if it's not, especially at a place like that where it's like, I went from there to the Daily Show, and the Daily Show was like this well-oiled machine. Yeah. And I got there when John was like, tell whatever stories you want, we'll make it funny. And so I had like a personal stake in everything. And I had a lot of ownership because I was like in the field department. So I was writing and directing these little short films for him. And it was just like night and day.
That sounds incredible.
It was incredible. I didn't think I was going to stay for 3 years, but I stayed until John like retired from the show. And that was when I left and did American Cunt in Edinburgh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a great name for a show.
Yeah.
How did people... I'll go on to American Cunt, but I'd love to talk about...
When was your first Fringe?
My first Fringe was like, let's say, my first Fringe show was called Alison Spittle Needs an Agent. And it was when I didn't have an agent. And it was a cry for help that was not answered.
That sounds like a good guardian, a cry for help that was not answered. Some press review.
It's like basically I had 50 minutes of material. So I didn't have a show. I was just doing it long enough that I had accumulated enough jokes to.
But did you, by the end of the month, did you end up with a show?
By the end of the month, I became a way better comedian. Yeah. I had like a whole, so a TV company was documenting comedians on different levels. So I was the comedian that was going over to Edinburgh for the first time.
What year was this?
This was, what are we at now? We're at 2019. So I would say 2014.
Oh, okay.
I would say 2014. Yeah, let's say that. It's 2014, and it was the first year I did Vodafone, actually, as well. And I remember the documentary ended on me crying.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Saying, I haven't validated myself as a comedian.
Oh, my God. Why do we do this?
I know. I was like, it was very rainy that year, and I was flyering. And also the show was, I was trying to do things where I had like a little graph talking about my ambitions, and it was fine, you know, but I came back and my first club gig, I just murdered people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You get so good at it.
Yeah. Cause I did a show to two people in Edinburgh, and they were both sat the furthest away from each other.
They were like a husband and wife.
I know.
This is like their like sex game.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, let's make this woman feel bad.
Foreplay.
Yeah. So like there was one woman that was laughing on that side and this other lady that wasn't. And I just stopped the show maybe about 20 minutes in. And I was like, look, I'm just checking in with you. Are you okay? And, you know, I was just whatever. And the lady said like, my English isn't good, but I'm having a good time. And aww. I was like, thank you. That made me feel so better.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was intensely awful. Yeah. But I mean, you have to go back and you have to do it. And
I'm amazed that you guys do that. That you do a new show every year.
Yes.
And it's such. I've never done the month. I did in 2011. I came over. I did the Free Fringe, and so I just did a bunch of shows.
Nice.
Just for like maybe 10 days. And then in 2015 is when I brought American Cunt, and I only did 2 weeks at The Stand.
You only did 2 weeks?
Yeah,
I did. But I heard so much about that show. I feel like it was
thanks.
Like, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I did the last 2 weeks of The Fringe. And I think, yeah, it was interesting because that show, the version that I took to The Fringe, I wrote it at The Fringe. And then a year later, like I was kind of touring it a little bit during the lead up to our election. And I didn't know it was going to be Hillary versus Trump. No one did. And the show just kind of like evolved where it became this like documentation of like America, like, you know, America and gender and all this kind of stuff where you're like, I think like one of my favorite jokes in the show I wrote like a week before we filmed it, and we filmed it for CISO, rest in peace. You can see it, you can listen to it on Spotify, I think, or iTunes. I'm very proud of the show, but it was kind of like the whole year I was fighting the idea of like, this is about this election, like it's about gender, because it's like you don't want to be like a female comic being like, it's about women, because people are just like, at least then people would like tune out.
Yeah.
But then there was like, as it became Trump, and I remember in 2015, I mentioned Trump's name during my show because I was writing the show while I was there. And people just laughed at the mention of his name. And I was like, in my mind, I'm not going to talk about Trump. It's too easy. He's not going to be the candidate. So I'll just not even go there. This is like August of 2015. And then like leading up to the actual show, I think I had a joke that was like, you know, it's not that Hillary's a woman. If it's not that she's a woman, but like if only there was like a way we could know for sure, like if you could conduct like a social experiment and like hypothetically put Hillary up against, I don't know, the worst candidate known to mankind, just some like racist asshole idiot, like, you know, Monopoly Man or whatever, and like then
then
you would actually see like what percent of America would rather like watch like an asteroid crash into our democracy than a woman lead it. And it wasn't that simple, but in like a way it kind of felt like it was. So it was like that show was very cathartic. And then this show that I'm doing now at Assembly Room 5 at 9:20 p.m. every night.
Nice.
Called, thanks for letting me plug that, called Miscarriage of Justice.
That's the least I can do.
I mean, you came to see me work it out at 2 North Down.
Yeah.
That was nice of you.
Oh, no, it was good to watch. It was, because, like, I mean, I was there, you know? So yeah. I was like, that would be rude of me.
Oh, that was like, really cool. I mean, yeah. I'm still working it out. I'm still trying to figure out the ending. And you want the ending to kind of reveal itself. That's like, I mean, with American Cunt, the ending revealed itself right before the election. But like, this one is kind of like an extension of American Cunt. It's a little bit, I don't know how it's different. I think American Cunt I pulled from 8 years of comedy, and this is like pulling from just like 2 years of slipping into fascism. So I think it's a little sadder and darker than American Cunt. American Cunt had like this optimism and naivete of thinking that. There was like one point in the show I'm so embarrassed about, but I like mentioned our Republicans and I'm like, I should say conservatives because by the time this special airs, that party may no longer exist.
Oh my God.
So stupid.
The hubris.
I know. But then there are also parts that for people kind of who weren't tuning in then and are now, I've had people write and say that the show is very prescient. Which is always fun to hear. And then there were like parts in the show. There's one specific part on gender that I just like, when I re-released it, I took it out because it just didn't reflect how I feel anymore. And the show is about gender and women. And it was right as like Caitlyn Jenner kind of became Caitlyn. And so I talked about that a little bit, but I never felt that it was in any way transphobic. And that was never my intent. But then this like website of TERFs, Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminists, found it. And they're like, yeah, we love this. And then I was
like, oh no.
I know. I was like, that's not what I meant. And so I just took it out of the show. And it actually wasn't, in my mind, it wasn't transphobic, but I'm also not a trans person, so I don't get to decide what's transphobic. And so I just took it out.
Yeah, yeah. It's better that way anyway. It's
For sure.
No, it's they seem like humorless melts anyway, trans exclusion feminists.
Yeah, I think it's a generational thing too.
Yeah, it's sad because I feel sorry for them, but sometimes when women talk about like being attacked and feeling like it's triggering, I feel bad for them. But like,
I don't think they use the word triggering, that generation. But that generation just has been so like beaten up like by men and having to live in like any like women over like 50 or 60 in at least in America, like you know, like we only had like access to credit cards in like 1974 or 5. That before then,
it was just men.
Yeah, you couldn't get credit.
What?
I mean, but it's got to be the same in Ireland. Oh, I mean, would imagine.
We've got access to
abortion.
Yeah, that's true. A big thing in the 70s was that like women weren't served pints because of pints of alcohol because it was seen as unladylike. So there's this feminist called Nell McCafferty who got a whole pub full of women to order a brandy and a pint. And so they'd ordered a brandy first and they go, and a pint please. And when the barman says, no, I'm not serving you a pint, they'd drink the brandy and not pay and go elsewhere.
This is like, that's such an amazing reflection of both of our cultures. Like in mine, it's like, women couldn't get money to buy things, and you're like, women couldn't get alcohol to drink.
That's true.
And both of our cultures are so fucked up in like the ways that they're fucked up. But it is really funny, like even like internationally, like I'm sure it'd be funny if like a French woman were here and she'd be like, women couldn't get
cigarettes.
Yeah, women couldn't get cigarettes, or like, you know, like women couldn't get I don't know, what's a French thing? Yeah, cigarettes.
Croissant cigarettes.
Mm. I was thinking like what male French prostitutes.
Nice.
No, that's not cool. But Italian women, like, you know, every different like injustices of two of my friends have a podcast, or not a podcast, it's an Audible audiobook called The Indignities of Being a Woman.
Right.
Meryl Marco. I don't know if I told you about this, but Meryl Marco and Megan Keister.
Okay, no.
And it's like 10 chapters, and each chapter is like a different subject. One is like health, education. I don't know if education's in there, but beauty, medicine. And they found, like, I think Meryl, who was like the co-creator of Late Show with David Letterman, and totally Whoa. Not as credited as she should have been. But
that's
she's
fucked up that I haven't heard of her.
Yeah, she's just brilliant. She goes from like, when we went from hunter-gatherer to like agrarian societies until like the 1950s, and then Megan takes on from the 1950s until now, and they both kind of go in their corners and do a bunch of research and find the things that they found most shocking, and then they come back and talk about it on each subject. And it's so, I think when I was in Kilkenny, I had really bad jet lag, and I was like waking up at 11 p.m. being like, who wants to get coffee? And nobody was around and nothing was open, so I was like, I need to listen to this. And it was just 8 hours, but I listened to all of it in like 3 days, and I loved every second of it.
Oh my gosh, I've got so many Audible credits as well.
Yeah. It's so good. It feels like you're just kind of like hanging out with like two really smart, funny friends and learning the craziest shit.
Have you heard, I listened to Nell Scovell's Just the Funny Parts.
Oh, cool, yeah.
And that's crazy. Like,
I need to listen to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nell's always been really cool to me.
That's cool.
Yeah. She wrote an essay in, I think, Vanity Fair about her experience at Letterman. And the whole thing was like, hire more women. And then a year later, I was hired. Yeah. And it was like cool to just like, I think it's hard in entertainment, and it's getting easier, but I think, you know, so much about our industry is your relationships with people and not appearing difficult, and like you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. And as a woman, it's like so much harder to navigate. Like, you know, every job comes from like your personal relationships and how people perceive you. So it is hard for us to kind of name names and like talk shit, even if it's valid. But so for Nell to write that article, even though, you know, she was at a stage in her career where I feel like she could. But it is hard for us to call out stuff because it directly affects our income.
It's so hard, but I feel like there's an added pressure on the women to do it.
Oh, men this is never... almost just women. Like, I think with men, it's not even.
It's like they have no skin in the game at all. Like they don't get affected by it.
Yeah, therefore. Well, people immediately in our cultures, I think, just there's a likability element that we were talking about the other night at the show.
Yeah.
Like, I think, you know, like, any woman doing comedy, even if she's reinforcing stereotypes, is still political comedy, because you're any woman or any person on the margins, any, you know, like, if you're in this, you know, white or male-dominated space and you're taking up space and you're speaking in a way where you're trying to like get laughs, which is inherently like powerful. You are like, that's political. You're interrupting something that didn't make a space for you.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So I think it's just harder to kind of swim against the grain.
It's crazy. It's like I was in a room.
Grain? Do you swim in grain? Swim against the stream. Go against the grain.
Yeah, I'm not gonna.
I swim in grain.
I swim. Yeah, it's very hard to swim in grain. It's the.
Yeah, that's what comedy is. It's swimming in grain and against the grain.
I found. Do you know what's so weird? I was like, I was at a festival and I was in a room full of comedians, and I was kind of looking around and I was like, it's almost like I was it's not like there was a civil war, but I was almost going like, that person enables that abuser, you know, that type of thing. And then I'm thinking, why am I bothered by this? Why do I, I don't want to, like, I feel like I'm going to hurt my career one day by, like, saying the wrong thing, or sometimes I get so mad.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're all, like, one tweet away from getting fired.
Oh,
but
buddy, I've my drafts are just full of.
Yeah. Or we've worked for someone who got fired from tweeting something stupid.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, I mean, for sure. And also women are held to higher standards for, like, our words than men are for their actions.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but that said, you know, you're such a kind, wonderful, talented person that you have a lot of people that who have your back. And
yeah.
I think the more you progress in the industry, the more of that you build. So you do become, like, you know, more, like, insulated by people who I think that a lot of, at least in our industry, some of my favorite people are comedians and female comedians and male comedians too. But I just, like, it's a really good group of people. There are some people that are kind of, you know, trickier.
Yes.
but for the most part, it's a good group of people. And also we are in a moment now more than ever. Like, I started in 2005 doing comedy, 2004, and it's changed so much for the better.
So much for the better. And I think it is more women. It, like, when I started in Dublin, I didn't meet this other female comedian called Niamh Maron for 2 years because we were just never on the same lineups because it was just one woman per lineup.
And Dublin's so small, you could have just seen her on the street.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, I was living in a rural part of Ireland at the time. I was getting a bus up and down. So yeah, actually, when I moved up to Dublin, I met her. But it's also like this, like, I feel safer or something. I feel like you can talk more. And I love men, though. Like, most of my friends when I grew up were boys.
Same with me.
Yeah. So I'm like, I really genuinely have no. And probably most of my social circle now. Yeah, like, it's a mix, but I have this great affinity with women. I just, like, especially female comedians.
Yeah, female comedians are cool.
They're the best types of people.
Yeah,
because they just.
I think we also, not to generalize, but I do think we get into comedy for different reasons, maybe on average than men. Is that a weird thing to say?
I don't think so. I'll have to hear the reason.
Well, from guys, and this is guy friends of mine, and I could be wrong, but they're like, they get into comedy to, like, get the girl. Like, and a lot of times when people, like, complain about female comics, it's like that same thing. It's like, men have to be funny to, like, get the girl. But, like, obviously we don't go into comedy for that reason.
No.
Or maybe some of us do.
Because we'll,
like,
be very disappointed.
Yeah, but it's like, I don't know why. I mean, why did you get into comedy?
I got into comedy because I was working in a radio station. And a comedian.
You can say.
Yeah, working as a DJ.
Comediante or whatever.
Comediante, yeah. So, like, he was working as a breakfast DJ, and I was always kind of joking about in the office, and he said, you should do stand-up comedy. And I said, no. And then he goes, we'll do it as, like, a challenge on the radio. So then I did it, and I was so scared at the start. Like, it was just... He goes, you got 2 weeks, 5 minutes of material you have to come up with. And I was like, cool. So I did most of it was just anecdotes about my granny. And when I think about it now, the gig must have been terrible. It must have been
That's so kind and cool that he did.
Oh, he's super lovely. I don't like, he's super lovely. And do you know what the really cool thing was? He gave me a number of the guy who runs an open mic. And then he was like, okay. That's all you need. Go. You know what I mean? It's just like, he's like, here you go. It was just like a passing thing for him. And then, but the feeling I had after I did stand-up comedy for the first time was this incredible adrenaline rush of just, I felt so powerful. It's so weird. It's just like, and also I felt like I was good at it. And I didn't feel like I felt that about a lot of stuff that I did. So then I just pursued that, like, as much as I could. So, yeah. I love being on stage, and I love the 2 minutes after, even if it went badly, and you can just have a big think, you know?
So you love the feeling after being on stage?
Yeah, that thing of, like, you walk down the steps and you have a big outtake of breath of, like, ah,
yeah,
that's done. Like, almost like you've scratched an itch or
something like that.
But the aspects of comedy I don't like is writing structure. But that's about, you know, I'm just, yeah, but I, it's that weird kind of, you, when you're up on stage, do you think much? I don't think much. I'm just like,
I mean, it depends how like much I've been doing it. Like for this festival, I've been working on my Edinburgh hour so much that I haven't been doing like the tight 20 minute mm-hmm. kind of big club crowds. So I'm in my head very much here because I'm doing the wrong jokes for the crowd. Like I'm doing like miscarriage jokes and abortion jokes, and they're like some they're not killing.
Yeah.
And I know I can change it up. I know what they want, but I just don't. I just have to prep for Edinburgh. So I'm kind of doing trickier material that's, you know, less mainstream, and then I get upset about it. I get like a little sad about it after. It's just like this kind of thing that it never goes away. But I do think audiences are getting hipper, even the mainstream ones, in a really cool way. Like, yeah. I listened to Des Bishop after me, and he was like just basically telling like a drunken crowd to be like nice to women and that women can say no at any time. And you're like, wow, like this is cool. This is gonna like sink in with like at least one person in this crowd, you know?
Yeah,
and so
crowds,
I think, even mainstream crowds, and partly because of like Netflix and, you know, just like how ubiquitous, how much comedy there is everywhere, are becoming so much more sophisticated. But I do remember when I first started doing comedy, I would like perform at like a club in Chicago, and it was like the same thing, doing like a 20 minute spot or like a 10 minute host spot. And you know what's going to get them, you know what the drunken late night crowds want. And it's like sex jokes.
Yeah.
You know, dick jokes, lowbrow stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that's going to make them laugh. But then I would do them and I would like kill. And then I would get off stage feeling just sad. Because it was like, this isn't what I want to say. These, like this audience there, at least it was like Midwestern dads from like Peoria, Illinois, that I was just like, we're not friends. And I'm like telling you stuff that's like, like joking about how like oh, like, you know, like I was drunk and you're just like, ew, you know, or like, yeah. I that's not, that gets people on a level laughing, but it doesn't make you feel like good.
Well, how do you feel about,
and this is over 10 years ago, like I don't do that anymore, but that's also kind of why I stay under the radar, because I'm really doing like kind of challenging stuff that doesn't make everybody laugh.
And like how do you kind of like, how would you describe the audience that you've built up? Like, who are these people?
They're, you know, I do really well in Washington, D.C. I do really well in San Francisco, New York, and London. Those are kind of like where I do the best right now.
Right.
So they're kind of, you know, I'm sure there's a marketing term for my demographic. They definitely aren't like people that buy a ton of stuff.
Oh, like, nice.
Or they're not the coveted. But you know, I'm increasingly with the Adult Swim show, I do have like young guys like writing me a lot, which is kind of funny. And like they'll come to my stand up and like not expect that, and then they'll just get it, and they seem to be into it.
That's good though.
It's
like
great.
People that you need to reach,
like 20-year-old gamers and stuff. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. God, you're doing a service.
I'm trying. But no, it's still very, very much under the radar. But it is like, you know, people that are kind of, I think with this current show, I've had a lot of feedback of women particularly being like, that was really cathartic. Thanks. Because mm-hmm. I also think, at least in our country, there's so much misinformation. Like right now, something I'm like very sad about, I just feel like 2020 is going to be the same thing as 2016. And you go online, the trolls are out, and they're so good at making you feel like crazy.
Yeah.
And even when you say something that's like a slight misstep or whatever, they just attack and they get personal, and it's, and some of them are real people and some of them are like trolls or bots. And it's just like, I just see the left of our country just kind of being pushed farther apart, and people underestimate the power of like disinformation campaigns on social media to make people jaded and not want to participate in the democratic process. And so that's something I'm really scared about. And that also makes me really excited, not excited, but like appreciative of the medium of comedy, because you can actually talk to people in a room. And I've definitely had, I had one situation in London when I was like working at the show, and I've written about it since, but I actually had some kid heckle me because I was like talking about Bernie Sanders, who's kind of like our Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
And he said something, and then I made a joke, and the audience laughed, but then he kept talking, and as you know, and this is, when I was working out the show, and when somebody keeps talking after you shut them down with a joke, it, becomes a thing, a situation you have to, address. And he kept talking, because he was like, I love Bernie, why won't you listen to me? And I was like, because I'm not at your show. And then I just kind of, I was tired, and I was like, dude, just, get out. And I've never done that in my life. And then he's like, I want to stay. I think you're funny. And I was like, okay. And then I made, a joke about how, we're going to hook up later because everyone loves sex stuff.
Yeah.
But everything was cool. I diffused it with comedy. And then I went online, and I was like, this is a problem with, the bulk of Bernie's base, which it's not the bulk, but it was, a problem with an element of Bernie's base. It was, white dudes with beards who come to your show and tell you to listen to them.
Yeah.
And that tweet, went crazy viral, and I got trolled massively for it, to the point where people were like, she wasn't even in London, she didn't even have a show, she's lying, she's a neocon, Hillary Schill. People be Zionist, corporate Democrat, just real crazy stuff, and you just get massively trolled, and then they're like, release the audio from the show, and it's like, I don't want to poke a hornet's nest, I don't want to release the audio, because I'm just going to give you more of what, and I, to my fault, I was I wasn't kind to him.
Yeah.
And then, but it all worked out. And then it was just, and then some comedian who is a Pizzagate conspiracy guy, retweeted
wonderful.
It. And it's just and then talked about it on his YouTube show, and a lot, it's just
is that Paul Crowther or something?
No, someone else.
Someone else, there's
yeah.
another one.
But then, and then there are a lot of comics now getting paid by RT and Sputnik, who are state-sponsored propaganda. There are people just totally being radicalized.
That's scary.
It's so scary. I was on a radio show in London where I kind of mentioned how, Fox News needs to be sent. You can't, I don't know why in America you can't say fuck on TV, but you can completely lie or, air somebody who's lying. They should be censored. Mm. So then he's like, you want to get rid of Fox News? What about CNN? And I'm like, I don't work for CNN. I'm just I just think lying is dangerous and propaganda is dangerous and hate speech actually kills people.
Mm-hmm.
And so but the there are so many forces where when you just try to say something, they are attacking you, and it's going to get worse before the election. And it is, not to get on this topic, but it is so exhausting to try to all I want is for us to vote against Trump. And all I want is to for us to try to not slip into fascism, and I think we're fucked.
Yeah, I think,
not to get into it, because
yeah, but I think the consensus is he's probably gonna get reelected, because
is that isn't. That's how I feel. Well, he didn't get elected to begin with, he wasn't democratically elected.
Yeah.
And the Electoral College in our country is really a relic of slavery that was put into the Constitution to placate slave states, to give more power to slave states.
Oh,
so the
God.
Electoral College should be eradicated. We shouldn't have it.
Is it just the Republicans that want to keep that then? Or
yeah. And I think, the whole thing now, at least in our country, our Constitution was made to stave off fascism. It has checks and balances, but ultimately the people who were the authors of the Constitution, white male slave owners. So, that's who was protected in the initial inception of our country. That said, it's a pretty dynamic document that has a lot of really good checks and balances, assuming an entire branch of the government hasn't been bought by mm-hmm. The NRA or Russia or whoever. And what we're seeing now is a lot. I mean, Mitch McConnell, there was a bipartisan bill that they were trying to pass to stop election tampering, to have paper ballots, and Mitch McConnell, who's
yeah.
He just wouldn't he wouldn't pass it. And it's that is the most bold-faced anti-democratic move, and he's doing it in broad daylight, so it's he is compromised somehow, because there's no reason that you can't say, do we care about this country, let's make sure that our votes aren't compromised. But I think the Republican Party right now knows that the majority is not with them, and that they have to have election tampering or an undemocratic process for them to stay in power.
So it's a coup.
Yeah, that's what I've been calling it. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's great.
And I think the majority of people watching from the outside like think the majority of Americans support Trump, but here's what it is. It's 50% of Americans like don't vote. Okay. Mm-hmm. And maybe like, and the majority who did, Hillary won by over 2 million votes. But so like a quarter of Americans, you know, do support Trump, or less than a quarter of Americans. But, you know, that's kind of how, like, I've been reading a lot to try to understand what's happening. And like all liberal democracies have elements of fascism in them. It's like, if you're not going to squelch dissenting voices, some of them are going to disagree with you. And that's just like natural and healthy for democracy. But then when like there are misinformation campaigns like Fox News has been since 1995, and then there's like Russia and interference and trolls and bots, like they actually have really been effective at radicalizing people. And also like Trump was like a TV star and people like, you know, felt safe with him. And I don't think all of his base are necessarily racist. I think a lot of them have been like duped by his, you know, presence on The Apprentice and thinking that he's a good businessman and he can like help them. And like the last thing I'll say about it, because I'm fully ranting now.
Yeah, no, it's cool though. Like this is.
Did you see the movie Us by chance? Jordan Peele.
I didn't. I've been so bad this year with watching films. I haven't seen Midsommar.
It's terrifying.
Right.
And it's awesome. And I think it's like one of the best examples of like, it's like almost like an allegory for like how Trump won. Like I think without giving anything away, it's kind of like when you leave people in the shadows, they will come back to kill you.
Right.
And in like our like late stage capitalist economy, like we, you know, manufacturing jobs have gone overseas. All these small towns like don't have a way to survive. Like all kind of like are like blue collar working class people like don't have the jobs that they had like 30 years ago. So they're like angry, they're unemployed, and it's easy to radicalize people on like very primal fears of like immigration and race because they're hurting, you know? And so I think in our country, like we all can move to the cities and have jobs, but there are huge swaths of our country where people like they don't have education, they don't have access to resources, and they're angry. And this is what we get. You know, you get unfettered populism on the left and the right. With the left, it's with like a contingent of Bernie's base is very vocal and like mad at me when I'm like, Elizabeth Warren's great. And they're like angry, and they're like Trump supporters, but the other side of the coin. When the system hasn't worked for you for years, you're like, fuck the system. Same thing with Brexit. When the system doesn't work for people, they're just like, let's torch the system.
There's like, because my dad voted Brexit. He's British, and like, I disagree with him on Brexit. And I think that his optimism is misplaced. But I think to say you're optimistic about stuff takes away any argument of you having to. It's almost like an emotion. It's going, of you're in a negative headspace, Alison. This might not happen. But they can't prove it.
Do you think Brexit's going to happen?
I hope not. If it does, I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm no expert. But I think it won't. I think it'll keep getting delayed. I can't see it happening this year.
I was weirdly more comfortable with Theresa May.
Boris Johnson will be. I think there'll be a re-election called. I think his own party, the MPs didn't vote. I mean, the last time he tried to run, when Theresa May was prime minister, the MPs were very against him becoming, even having a chance of being prime minister. But I know that the people in his party were just. Landslide, we're going to vote for him straight away.
I mean, what I've seen the past 2 years, I have no optimism left.
I have optimism in the ineptitude of people getting stuff done, so I feel like
that's funny.
The same.
It was always interesting to me that like Theresa May is diabetic. Just because with insulin and Brexit, like you can only stockpile insulin for 2 weeks. There's like a 2 week shelf life.
Wow.
And you don't, they don't make insulin in the UK. So it was like, I think, so it was like this thing of like, even though like the reason that she's like pro Remain is because maybe she knows that like people with diabetes will be totally screwed.
Yeah. That it's that weird kind of empathy that people get with when
it's in their backyard.
Oh, talking about Theresa May's backyard. My granddad used to live on her road.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and now there's armed police there all the time. And there will be from now on, you know, they'll be protecting her. You get your guards. But it's so weird because I've moved to London to Britain, and when Brexit happened, I was like, oh, I don't give a shit. I live in Dublin. But then I had to move there. So I'm like, oh no, stuff's going to happen. How do you stay optimistic, or how do you not throw yourself off a bridge knowing what you know?
Well, there are a couple things. One, for women, and this is super privileged, you know, I'm like a white, you know, Jewish white woman living in America in 2019. But it's been worse for us. So I do think, and in comedy, as we were talking about, like seeing the changes that we've seen where like women and people of color and people on the margins are like, not only their voices are being heard, but they're getting paid.
Yes.
Like that's exciting. So there is, I've seen progress. And I don't like the term optimism because I think it breeds complacency. But I do think, you know, I am hopeful because there are more of us than there are of them. At least in America, we have a lot of really exciting young women and just women in general in politics now, like in Congress. And the people voted for them. You know, the midterms didn't have the election tampering. And so you could see where America actually voted.
Who excites you?
I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib. Just a ton of, there are just a bunch of, I love Elizabeth Warren. You know, I really, really like her a lot. And it really makes me sad that so much of Bernie's base doesn't get how great she is. And also that, like, Bernie kind of has started to attack her a little bit. That's very upsetting because she's a very, I think she's a very compelling candidate. She headed the Consumer Protection Bureau under President Obama, and she, out of anybody, I think, will be like skilled enough to stand up to like corporations and to stand up to like Putin. And I think she needs Bernie's base to be behind her for her to even have a shot.
Right.
And I don't see that happening. Because then I also see a lot of like, you know, corporate Democrats really being afraid of her. And I think like the messaging in our country has to be like, we throw around socialism like it's a bad word, but in reality, like, our country is socialist, but just for billionaires. So, like, if you're a billionaire, you get tax breaks. Like, you can be a McDonald's CEO and, like, all of your employees have to, like, use government subsidies, and that's why they can be your employees because they're on food stamps. So, like, Walmart, every time Walmart moves into a town, like, it fucks up the local economy, and all the people who work for Walmart, even though they're creating jobs, are also, like, spending so much money, taxpayer money, feeding their employees because they pay them so little. The employees are like below the poverty line and have to rely on social services.
That should be illegal.
Yes. So like I think people are kind of starting to see it, but if people like understood that like we are socialist already, but just for like the top 1%, you know? Yeah. Like
in America, you don't have maternity leave, is that true? Or
No, it's not like mandated. We also haven't ratified the Equal Rights Amendment.
Oh.
So, you know, it's been worse. But right now, if you're like a girl in like Louisiana or like Alabama, it's pretty bad.
That is, and it's mad how in the UK people got very up in arms about the abortion rights of Alabama and stuff. And that Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
We're in the exact same position.
Yeah. Like, but if you just look at the statistics, like, you know, outlawing abortion is not going to decrease abortions. Like, when you make abortion legal, less people have them. So, like, if you actually are pro-life.
Yeah.
Like, in the states that are quote-unquote pro-life in America, they have the highest rates of maternal mortality and the highest rates of infant mortality. So it's, like, they're not pro-life, and we need to be, like, talking about this stuff and, like, picking it apart because, I mean, the problem is, like, people are so radicalized and they just, like, tune out, so they don't want to hear, like, the data-driven reality of these policies. But you just got to keep screaming them.
What was the first thing that you kind of did comedy-wise that you felt very passionate about? Like I feel like when I watch your comedy, you make a lot of points and there's a lot of information. It's hilarious, but like this, you know, it's stuff that I feel it's almost like a comedy rally in a way. You know,
that's the way. But active, yeah.
Yeah, but like when you first started doing comedy, what were you doing? Comedy about actually what was your
so I had this like passion project. Have you heard of American Girl Dolls?
Yeah, brief. So I'll describe what I think they are.
Sure,
and
sure.
You correct me.
Sure, sure.
So is American Girl Dolls like a shop that you can go drink tea at with these dolls.
Okay, so America, yes,
Build-A-Bear or
no. So American Girl started as this doll company. This woman created this doll company where she had like little dolls from periods in American history, and they each came with like a book that told you about the doll. There was like a doll from the 1920s. There was a doll from the turn of the century. There was a doll that was like involved in labor riots.
This is great.
There was a doll that was a runaway slave to talk about slavery. And then when Mattel, who owns Barbie, bought the company from this woman, Pleasant T. Rowland, they just kind of really commodified and commercialized it in this crazy way. But then the dolls still were like dolls that had books attached to them. And then what happened like a couple years later, they started phasing out the historical collection because like you could have dolls where you could like make a doll to look like you, and all the little girls like just wanted that doll. So now they have like a doll of the year, which is like a contemporary doll. And then they have like a American Girl cafe where you can have like tea parties and birthday parties. They have a hospital to fix up your doll. And I was like working in a political sketch show in 2005, and American Girl's doll of the year, her backstory was that she fled her dangerous neighborhood of Pilsen in Chicago and moved to like Downers Grove, which is this like very sterile suburb in Illinois. And the people of Pilsen, this like very proud Mexican-American community, protested this depiction of them in this American Girl doll book. And I was like, that's pretty funny. So it's fucked up, but it's funny. So then I created like, I was like, American Girl is launching their new refugee collection. And so I had like a little refugee from each country.
Yeah.
And so each show I was like, this is Fallujah Jones. Like she fled her dangerous neighborhood of like Baghdad or whatever. And just kind of like
Fallujah Jones.
Yeah. Just like whitewash these like refugee experiences. And at the time they actually had a play in the Chicago store that was like a sales pitch for the entire collection of dolls called the American Girl Review. And the whole premise was like a new girl moves to town and the other girl's like, we want you to join our American Girl Club. So we're going to introduce you to the collection through like song and dance and valuable life lessons. And then you'll join our club. So I saw that. I was working at Improv Olympic in Second City at the time. And I was like, this is like so ripe for parody. And I just created a parody where I had like a collection of like 10 refugee girls all around the world, one on like every continent. And then I had like Lily Lakota, no last name, who was like a Native American who lived on a landfill. And Bahati, whose name means luck in Swahili, who's like a Darfur refugee who was like adopted by Angelina. This is very like 2007.
Yeah.
I had an Inuit whose igloo melted from global warming. Pain Gone, who floated over on a tsunami from Indonesia. And just like dark, but like sugar-coated. And in the story, these two girls, Katrina and her little sister Rita, off of like Katrina, storm in New Orleans. They're two internally displaced people, and they go to this town in Peoria.
Right.
And they are black girls, and everyone else is like white. And the white girls are like, well, you don't know what it's like to be a real refugee, so we're going to teach you with our dolls. And it was like kind of making fun of like Mean Girls and the commodification of refugee. Anyway, it was like my passion project. And I did it in Chicago and with a whole cast of like women, just really funny comedians. And they were like, my friend Fazia Mirza was in it and she's still working in comedy and just a really talented cast of people. And Chicago Theater viewed it. They criticized the set design. They were like, this is like a summer camp talent show. Like, it's totally amateur. And then we took it to the New York Fringe and they completely got it. Time Out New York gave it like 4 stars and was like, this is like a edgy political satire, like written by like a 23-year-old with a cast of like funny women and like women of color who are hilarious, like just like white women and women of color, just like a diverse cast of like funny women doing political satire in like 2008. Like,
yeah.
And they completely got it. And it was a really good lesson of like, don't read reviews.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
do read them, but take them in stride. And, you know, and then we put it up one more time in New York. But it was my like passion. As I talk about it now, I just like it was, I loved it so much. And I remember Time Out Chicago comedy, like didn't even really see it, but then they called it the worst comedic attempt of 2007. And that wasn't even in a category.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's like, it was such a lesson of like, if you're like doing threatening political shit. And I did, the last thing I'll say about it, I did change the show in one respect from the first run to the second.
Mm-hmm.
In the first run, we were like, we know this play may be a buzzkill, but donate to these local refugee organizations.
Mm.
In the second version, I took that out and we just were like, the last song was like a closing number that was like saying goodbye, but spelled B-U-Y, and the girls had like for like buy signs in every language, and they were like, buy stuff from us, and it was like a really aggressive sales pitch in like a unapologetic way. And it taught me this lesson about satire, which is like, if you apologize, you're screwed.
Right.
If you don't give them, if you're not like, we know this might make you feel bad, like if you don't give them that window to criticize you, and you just like do your satire and you just like go hard. But obviously you have to like know, like we didn't talk really about like sex trafficking too much. Like there were topics that I didn't really touch on because it was just too grim.
Yeah.
So you just kind of like know the line. But yeah, I know I'm totally ranting, but that was like a lesson I learned from that. And it was like, don't apologize. Do your research. Make sure you're like, I don't like the phrase bulletproof, but make sure you're bulletproof.
And yeah.
And then if you are, or you're confident in what you're putting into the world, then don't back down.
Oh my gosh. I feel this is a good lesson to end on. It's been so lovely chatting to you, Jenna. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah.
It was nice to be on a podcast of somebody that I actually talk to when I'm not on the podcast.
Nice.
So it's cool. So,
yeah. And I know it's like, it's cool chatting on a podcast with you because I chat to you about other stuff. But now I'm like, I got a full... I don't think if I sat with you in a pub and I go like, so tell me what it was like to work on this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're in the Edinburgh Fringe Festival from the 31st of July until August 11th, she's taking a day off on the 12th of August, and then it's from the 13th until the 25th. Jenna's show, Miscarriage of Justice, will be on at 9:20 in the Assembly George Square Studios 5. It's a super, super show. I watched a few work in progresses, and I just think she's like one of the best comedians going, so please check her out. Now, my stuff. I am on from the 31st of July until the 12th of August. I'm taking off a day off on the 13th, and then I'm back from the 14th until the 25th. And I am on in the Gilda Balloon in the balcony room. And I'm on every day from 5:15. So 5:15. My show is called Alison Spittle, Mother of God. And it's a show about not getting the part of Mary in a school nativity play and how not to hold a grudge. So please buy your tickets. Tickets are selling. So I'm excited. I didn't say whether they're selling well, but they are selling, so I'm super, super happy. Also, if you're based in Dublin, I'm going to be over for the Fringe Festival in Dublin with the same show, Alison Spittle, Mother God, but this time I'm going to be gigging in a church in Dublin Castle, the Chapel Royal. So I'm super, super excited about that. If you want more information, go to fringefest.com. Also, the next one. I also have another show in the Dublin Fringe Festival, and it's called Starlet, and it's a play. I wrote this play. Simon Mulholland, who I wrote Nowhere Fast with, is directing it, so we're collaborating again. And the two actors in it, Roxana Nicolene, who's in Fair City currently and is brilliant, and a former podcast guest, go have a listen to that episode. I really enjoyed that one. Because we talk about Tom Jones and also about comedy. It's really good. And then Peter McGann is also in it as well, who's a guy I really, really respect. And I think he's brilliant. And he's in loads of comedy stuff that I like around Ireland. So, yeah, please go check out Starlet. I'll tell you the dates now because I have it written on my phone. So Starlet starts on the 17th of September and it's on every day at 9:15 in Smock Alley, and it runs until the 22nd of December. So we're on a Saturday and a Sunday. We're finishing on the Sunday, but we've got two shows on those days. We've got a matinee at 4:30 and then evening shows at 9:15. The show Starlet is kind of based on, it's actually based on a story that I did on the podcast. And it's kind of dramatized, and I'm really proud of it, like genuinely very, very proud of it. I think it'll be good, and I think it'll be good because I'm just working with class people. I got a savage producer that just gets everything done. We're gonna have a Starlet special podcast coming out in September. And I'm going to give a shout out to all the lovely people who donated to the fund it for Starlet. And we'll have fun and it'll be good crack. Please listen to future episodes. There's going to be future episodes. I'm also going to be at Electric Picnic with a live Alison Spittle show there. And that's going to be, I think it's going to be about early Sunday afternoon. We haven't confirmed it yet, but I think it's either 12 or 2. And also, yeah, do you know what? There's a few more live shows that are coming up. When they get confirmed, I'll tell you. But I'm going back at the podcast pretty hard because I missed it and you've been so lovely. So thank you so much to Bobby Ahern from No Monster Club who did the theme tune. To William Conway, my old school friend who's now an animator and I'm really excited for him. He did my logo and for the podcast. And then thank you to Alan and Paddy from Headstuff for being a great support. But most of all, thank you so much to Sarah Garvey who produces the podcast. She edits it. She does everything. She's an amazing person. She's editing this now. I don't want to talk her up too much in case she gets embarrassed. But Sarah, I think you're great and I really appreciate you. I'm going to be in Edinburgh for the next little while. I'm actually in there now. I'm recording this in my new room. I'm kind of excited. I'm kind of scared. I'm very scared actually about it all. But I'm always really scared of Edinburgh. Yeah, so lovely to be doing the podcast again. Also, one thing, if you're in the UK or Ireland and you're looking to see the Jenna Friedman television special that we were talking about in the interview, it's called Soft Focus with Jenna Friedman, and you can get that on the All4 app. The, you know, the Channel 4 has its own kind of like iPlayer or its own version of the RT player. The All4 app is an amazing app, by the way. You can get like Turkey Rock and Handmaid's Tale and loads of stuff. It's absolutely free. They're not paying me, by the way. It sounds like they are, but they're not. It's just a good thing. And I'm doing it for ye. I'm telling ye the opportunity that you can have for free entertainment with All4. Of course, there's advertisements on it. And they're annoying. See? I'm not advertising All4 because I've just told you I can't. About it, but please watch Soft Focus. It's a brilliant, brilliant TV show. Yeah, have a lovely day. Oh my god, I'm so happy to be doing this again. Have a lovely day, chickens. Bye.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.